Yeah, do you want to give us like a...
Free pills.
I know it was been a long time, but do you want to give us like a rundown of what you were trying to show?
I'd rather actually hear your rundown of what I was trying to show.
Most
of what I was the paper as a whole, not this section, but the paper as a whole is arguing that philosophy cannot be as self-assured as it has for a long, long time taken itself, because it is created through metaphors, and particularly this one metaphor. But what I found interesting is if you read through the history of philosophy, philosophers denigrate metaphors or cast them aside or put them in a little box and say, this is when we use metaphors here and only here. And that's mostly for poetry. But when we're doing philosophy, we don't want to be poetic. We don't want to be flowery. We want to be clear and concise. So metaphors are bad. But if it's the case that your entire philosophical tradition, the Socratic philosophical tradition, is based on a metaphor, then it's sort of an Ouroboros of self-refutation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved the connection between what we were talking about last time with Francis Bacon uses light as a metaphor for both like kind of knowledge and the divine. And so the science, light, you know, so the metaphor of light is just like rampant. And here it's interesting because it like takes that head on. Talk about more the intellectual and the visual or the visible, but it's the same kind of thing, right? So you have like, you know, brightness becomes a metaphor for clarity of thinking, and darkness becomes a metaphor for the obscurity of thinking. And like I often use the example of during the Middle Ages, you know, after like say Abelard, you get another cluster of metaphors around knowledge and argument, right? All those war metaphors, right? When you undermine an argument, you stake your claim, you set out a position, you defend it against attacks, right? Like that whole entire cluster of like war metaphors that comes into it around the Middle Ages.
Yeah, that's right at the beginning of George Lakoff's book. I think like that's the first thing he takes on is like arguments are wars or battles.
Yeah, so I've definitely come across this book like secondarily before, so I'm probably getting it a little bit by osmosis from them, but that's like another group of metaphors, right? Like war metaphors for knowledge, and then like with pragmatism, even like you get economic metaphors, like cashing, what's the cash value of this idea kind of thing. And then you get like all these economic metaphors for ideas.
And morality. And morality is very often a spatial metaphor, right? It's like stooping so low. Why are you stooping so low? Like, oh, you took the high road, right? It's like...
And then today, contagion and viral and immunobiology is the big metaphor for dissemination and circulation.
The woke mind virus.
Oh, I heard that today too. Oh my God. It's a mind virus all of a sudden. Well, I've got a social disease.
For the listeners, the book that Victor's referring to is called, I think, Metaphors We Live By. I never finished it, but...
I remember a lot of pages of that book just go through like lists of metaphors, and it kind of is like a bit like, I don't want to, it almost feels like a devastating argument, because you're just like, well, how metaphorical is language? And then he just like goes on and on and on. And then you're just like, holy shit, literally like half the shit we say is metaphorical. You realize.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
Cool.
So I was using metaphor on the philosophy of metaphor, because the philosophy of metaphor by and large is don't use it. It's bad. It's confusing. It's obscuring. Yeah. But yeah, my attempt was to turn it. I'm just going to read the first or the second paragraph so we have a basis. This is where I kind of brought it into their common parlance, how we use metaphor day to day. The transfer from the visible to the intelligible is commonplace in everyday speech. Some examples will serve to demonstrate the degree of naturalization of the association between sight and knowledge. For instance, describing a cognitive position as a, quote, point of view, unquote, quote, unquote, seeing what a conversant means, bringing evidence to light, understanding a new perspective. Furthermore, one may shed light on a topic, illustrate a fact, clarify a point, authors focus on one thing or another within a certain scope, delineating that the terms of an argument references a strict division, that of all the senses is only possible in the realm of vision. The ignorance of the Dark Ages gave way to the pursuit of reason in the Enlightenment. This phenomenon, from phenomenon in Greek, things that appear, is not limited to English. No German, for instance, can miss the Schau in Anschauung idea, nor can a Frenchman fail to hear the voir, to see, in savoir, to know. In each example, cognitive comprehension is understood in terms of unobscured vision. Even in physical gestures, metaphors of vision indicate a connection with knowledge. So in a conversation, you might squint if you don't understand what the person is saying to you, or open your eyes wide if you suddenly realize what someone's trying to explain to you, an epiphany. So each of these examples associates the experience of knowledge with a clear vision to an extent that exceeds the other senses. And I think a little bit later go into a few of the senses, but it kept making me think, if it hadn't been this way, obviously humans, just as mammal machines, our sight is our relatively strongest sense compared to other animals. It makes sense that it becomes our most dominant metaphor, but I was just thinking, what would a philosophical tradition that was based on sound be like? Or what would one that's based on touch be like? We kind of brought that up, I think, once with Merleau-Ponty, late Merleau-Ponty, when he wants to turn to a touch metaphor as the basis of philosophy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of lends force to the argument here that it's hard to imagine that, like, right off the bat, they're doing visual analogies for intellectual knowledge, right? So, I mean, it's like I'm tempted to say the Greeks did work with a sound-based system, right? Because, like, writing and shit was expensive and not developed. But, apparently, even right from the beginning, they were doing that sort of. But, I've definitely read or, like, seen books that reference, I mean, you could think of even Marsha McLuhan's arguments about the oral and the visual. But even, you know, just that vision has been a dominant sort of force in even just like Western culture, visual metaphors and prioritizing the visual over the other senses.
Yeah.
Definitely been written about extensively, whoever you want to blame, Descartes or whatever.
Are there any like idea or knowledge metaphors that are like, that are sonic? Cause I was like looking through some of the list of Lakoff, like, cause he does have a bunch of other metaphors that like we'll all recognize where, yeah, like I would say light is dominant, but also kind of in common parlance, people talk about ideas as food all the time, right? Like, let me chew on that, right? That gives me food for thought. That idea is half baked, right? It's like, so there is like a kind of sense in which there's a bunch of food metaphors for knowledge too, which are kind of funny.
Yeah, like hearing can be mean understanding, right? Like, oh, I hear you, not just like literally I can hear you, but like, you know, I hear that, right?
Yeah, like, or like let me, or like give me some time to digest that information, right?
Kind of like, yeah, that one's like asking for time. I hear that is more expressing like a sympathy. I hear that.
To strike a chord,
the information.
But to strike a chord is not really intellectual. It's more an emotional resonance rather than a
striking a chord. Yeah, like pressing buttons.
We'll probably get a good list in the comments, I'm sure, because it's fun to
think about. Yeah, it's really fun to think about. Like, yeah. I like thinking about the food metaphors. Like, yeah, and you realize, like, you hear them all the time. Like, oh, like, don't sugarcoat that idea for me, right? It's like you're kind of making it easier to understand. Spoon feeding, right? It's like
pill popping. Well, it's not food.
But you're right. But like, light does seem to have the kind of, like, the most, I would say, like, it's most connected to philosophy as a form of knowledge for sure, right? Like, I don't think that like food. I mean, I guess it is used in some contexts as a metaphor when you're thinking about like philosophical ideas, but I agree, like when you think about the idea of clarity, right? Or something being, or like the process of understanding something complicated, like the visual metaphor does seem to be the one that is most ready to hand or something.
And even though the Greeks invented it, it gets merged with scholasticism, and all of the biblical metaphors then get trucked in as well. There's another metaphor, trucked.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Then all the metaphors of God and light, and God is light from the John's gospel, all those get pulled in. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all, yada, yada, yada. I don't know if I brought that up, but...
You'd think that an auditory metaphor would make sense, but it's like visual, just it feels so intuitive, because it's like, you know, when it's dark you literally just like can't, like it, you can't see that well, and it's just it feels, you know, it feels so intuitive to just be like, you know, ideas, it's like when all of a sudden it becomes really clear to me, it's like you want to think that like somehow a light has been shined right on,
yeah, you can see it, further,
I can see further. It's like it's making, yeah, it feels so intuitive. But I guess all these metaphors do feel intuitive. So like that's really not saying much in a way.
Yeah. The one thing that's been interesting to me lately has been like, yeah, like space. And so thinking about space in relationship to historicism. I mean, some people may be familiar with the spatial turn and the socio-spatial dialectic. But it's interesting in view of that to see how kind of visible metaphors, visual metaphors, because you must include spatial metaphors in there. I think Victor said that earlier. But space seems to be such an affair of the visible, whereas time is not. Time is something you have to keep track of, right? And then we have to use all these spatializing and spatial forms for time. We got to spatialize it on a clock or on a calendar in boxes or something like that, right? Space becomes a metaphor for time, or it becomes a kind of indicator of time.
Or to periodize, make epochs.
Yeah, and time lines and like everything. We're always spatializing time in visual form so that we can sort of understand it better. And... But I'm thinking more on the level of like, I don't know, Henri Lefebvre's production of space or something, and the way space has kind of become a container for everything that just like happens in it.
It's funny though, time is also often metaphorized with as money, right? People say like, I'm spending time.
Yeah, time is money.
right? Like, yeah, buy some time, spend time.
Yeah, saving time.
Yeah, saving time.
Save time on travel.
Or invest, yeah. Investing time.
Exactly.
But philosophy, I would say philosophy, I mean, we're bastardizing, but the philosophers are Hobbes, Locke, Aristotle, and Plato here. But you can see there's a kind of resistance for all of them to time also. They prefer space. They prefer clarity. They prefer boundaries, categories, you know, sorting, especially Aristotle loves his fucking sorting. But time kind of takes a back seat, just like the body, as opposed to the eye, takes a back seat.
But how do you use time to metaphorize, like, knowledge?
Big question. It sounds like something the Buddhists would do.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think it's so strange because I do feel like there's a way in which these metaphors develop. Because there is some kind of like a feeling that goes along with the concept that like you can't explain why. So, for example, I actually saw this, where was it? Like, I feel like it might have been some Twitter clip that I saw where someone was talking about like, you know, you can survey people and say like, is biting into a lemon, is the taste of a lemon a short taste or a long taste? And if you survey people, everyone says it's a short taste. It's like a quick taste. And it's like, what does that mean? Right? It's just like, there's just a feeling, right? And like that leads us to metaphorize it. And like there's no way to explain it rationally. It just seems to be that things feel certain ways and they lead us to certain metaphors. And like, I guess the point of bringing that up is like, certainly it's contingent, but there's like on circumstance. But there's another part of me that wants to say that like, there might just be like that ideas or certain concepts will just have a certain feel that will make it really awkward to metaphor. Like you just, it wouldn't work to metaphorize it in just any way. And I don't know why. It's just a feeling.
Yeah, I think when you're coming along to explain something like Plato wants to explain, you need these kinds of things, these analogies, these metaphors derived from kind of concrete experiential things and then applied to some other realm. I mean, this is the quote that's opened up with, the soul is like the eye. When resting upon that on which truth and being shine, the soul perceives and understands and is radiant with intelligence. So you see, the soul is like the eye, truth shines on things, right? And so you got these light and vision, soul and intelligence, radiant with intelligence. So this sort of lays the foundation of this metaphorical slippage, you could maybe call it, between the two realms, the visible and the invisible, or the intellectual and the visual. But the point is, it still is with us in our discourses on things, or especially in philosophy. We still have this kind of slippage between the visual and the intellectual.